our fifth case, the United States v. Robers. Mr. Donovan.
Thank you. May it please the court and may it please opposing counsel. My name is Chris Donovan. I represent Benjamin Robers on this appeal. The Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, which is the governing statute for this issue, is clear that once property is returned to a victim, a district court is then to subtract the value of the property on the date it's returned, or any part of the property that is returned at that time.
Now, this represents sort of a crystallization of the argument that you made in the district court, isn't that right? It wasn't quite as focused this way?
That's correct. It wasn't as focused. I wish I could have made it a little bit more clear to the district court. My argument in the district court focused on some other issues that aren't raised on appeal. For example, the apportionment argument, which I did not pursue on this appeal. And so I didn't phrase it as clearly, but this language was clearly before the court. It was cited by the government in its restitution memorandum, which is at the appendix, government's appendix, page 13. So clearly the court, which stated that it read all the party's submissions, I think was aware of the statute. It's the governing statute, and I think that the language is clear. Adopting the government's approach that it argues in its brief would not only go against the plain language of this statute, but I believe it would also needlessly complicate calculating restitution in criminal cases. And the district court expressed some concern that the law here isn't really clearly articulated, and also the government in its brief, I think, basically acknowledges that certain parts of the MVRA is not clearly defined, such as what value to use or when to define property is returned. But I believe that Congress, through the statute, has given district courts clear instruction on the process. And basically, I think it's a two-step process. One, the district court determines when the property was returned. And two, it then deducts the value of the property at that time from the victim's loss. And the MVRA is clear that, unlike, for example, guideline loss calculations, for restitution, only actual loss can be used as a loss amount. This process, again reflected in the plain language of the governing statute, affords certainty when determining restitution, it's non-arbitrary, and is fair in allocating risk in any loss of value to the property. That is, it would be the defendant who would bear the risk of loss in value before the property is returned. It would then be the victim that would bear the risk of loss in value once the property is returned, because now it's returned to them, the victim controls and decides what happens with the property.
Yeah, but the property that it relinquished was money.
That's correct. Other courts, and I cite to this on page 23 of my brief, argues in cases like this that the property that's used to secure the loan should be used as the offset value. Your Honor is correct that it is cash that the victim gave to the defendant, but clearly it's secured by a house. And it's secure, and so that should be taken off the value, because that is value that's imparted back to them when they gain control of that property.
Yeah, well, of course, when it's cash secured by a house, the house is usually more valuable than it's supposed to be. I know things
right.
Changed in the last few
well,
years.
Well, and that's what happened in this case. When this process isn't followed, that's laid out by the clear language of the statute, the defendant's culpability is skewed, and also the purpose of restitution is not achieved. And the purpose for restitution is to compensate victims only for losses caused by the conduct of the defendant underlying the offense of conviction. This is the Supreme Court speaking in the Huey case, which is cited in my brief. So, for example, I think the inlet property is the best example in this case. Inlet property, the loss to the victim was $330,000. That's the amount of the loan that they made to Mr. Robers, and that's what they extended. The property securing the loan was returned to the victim February 21st, 2006. So the first step in the process here for the court should be very simple. I think it's undisputed. I don't think the government's going to have any quarrel that the property was returned February 21st, 2006. Where the court went wrong, and where I think the main error in this case lies, is that the property was eventually sold to another third party over 31 months later on October 6, 2008. Again, this is clearly reflected in the record. So this is where the unfairness creeps in, reflecting Mr. Robers' culpability and need to compensate the victim, because after February 21st, 2006, he has no ability to control the property. He has no ability to determine what's going to happen to it. the bank at that point, or the victim, could have sold it immediately if they tried to. They could have sat on it to see if it would appreciate. They could have forgotten about it, and we don't know. We just don't know what happened after February 21st, 2006 for why the property sat for 31 months. One thing is certain, though, is that Mr. Robers at that point no longer had any ability to control the property, had no ability to decide what would happen with it, and therefore he should not be the one to bear the risk of any loss in value. And obviously that's exactly what happened. We all know in 2006, roughly, maybe then to 2005, is when the housing market begins to collapse. So right when he loses the control of the property, right when the victim gets the property returned, is when the market starts to fall. And this does put the victim not only where it should be pursuant to restitution, but in a better position, because basically the loss of the market, the risk of that, was put on Mr. Robers, even after he no longer had control of the property.
I take it you're not suggesting that the statute ought to be interpreted as a one-way ratchet.
No, obviously it could go either way. Right. Obviously, if the house would have increased in value, we wouldn't be here because then there wouldn't have been a loss to the victim in the first place. But no, defendants should neither be able to benefit from an increase in value of the property, nor should they be punished, though, for a decrease in the value of the property after it's no longer in their control. The one thing that the statute's not exactly clear on is what value to use when determining the offset value. Now, it's clear on when. Again, it says when the property is returned, that's when you value the offset property. But it's not clear on what value to use. And I think this is where this court should look at the Bocajna case. I probably am murdering the name. But it's the Second Circuit case cited in my brief that says really the only value that makes any sense would be the fair market value, because this is the price a seller is willing to accept and a buyer is willing to pay on an open market in an arm's length transaction. It also represents the property's greatest economic use. And I do think that's what needs to be done here. I think this case needs to be remanded so that the district court can figure out what the property was worth when it was returned in February of 2006 before the decline in the market, and basically comply with the plain language of the statute.
Do we know when the other property was returned?
We don't. We do know that the eventual sale price of the other property was $118,000. We don't even know the original loan amount for that property. We don't know when it was eventually sold to a third party, and we also don't know when it was returned. So if for nothing else, again, I think that this should be remanded to determine those dates and figures along with the inlet property. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. I'll cede to the government and save the rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan. Ms. Kraft.
Good morning, Your Honors. Please, the court. My name is Carol Kraft. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I represent the government on this appeal. I believe it raises two issues. And I think they're important issues in this circuit because it raises issues that at this point in time there is not really clear law. The first issue is, what is the proper offset for a district court to apply when, in the case of a mortgage loan, a mortgage fraud case where money was lent, the victim lender is forced to foreclose in order to secure the collateral that was that provided the security for that particular loan? And then the second one is, what are the expenses that are properly calculated as direct expenses as opposed to consequential direct losses as opposed to consequential losses in a mortgage fraud case? And I say that there's not clear law on this because the only case that I was able to locate on the issue of the offset was the Cage case that I cited in my brief. And I concede that's an unpublished decision, and it was a decision that was made in connection with an Anders brief. But in that case, the court opined that the sale of the property, the proceeds from the sale of the property, was a proper offset to be used against the loss on the loan. Now, counsel has suggested, and he has argued strongly here this morning, that the collateral must be valued at the time that the lender takes possession of it after foreclosure, and that the statute, the MVRA, mandates that should occur. And I would submit to you, first of all, that it is a plain error standard that the court ought to apply this morning because he never raised that issue below. His main issue was that his client should not be held accountable for the whole loss on this because he was a minor player and his economic circumstances were modest. And he also at some point argued that there was no loss on the loan because it was appropriately appraised in the first instance. My 28J letter that I filed yesterday referenced the Green case in which this court has previously recognized that, in fact, in a typical mortgage fraud case, properties are inflated for the very purpose of obtaining money. That's exactly what happened in this case. The defendant was a straw buyer in a multi-defendant, multi-property case where inflated properties were sold to straw buyers who misrepresented their assets and their income and their ability to pay. Mr. Robers went to those closings for those two properties. He signed the paperwork. He said, I promise, I pledge to pay the mortgage on these properties, and never made a single payment, nor did anybody else. And so those were the two arguments that he made. Now we're here with him arguing on appeal that, in fact, the district court erred by not applying the proper offset. I would submit that the MVRA does not require the district court to value a property when it's returned, a collateral, a property that serves as collateral, when it's acquired by a lender after a foreclosure action at the time that it takes possession. And the reason for that, and I think is what has been raised by the court this morning, what is, I guess, the analysis in the Smith dissent, which I cited in my brief. It's a Ninth Circuit case. It predates other Ninth Circuit cases, and the Ninth Circuit doesn't agree with the Smith dissent in that case. But in the Smith dissent, the court said, what was taken was money, and what the victim got back was property. He didn't get it back, though. The victim in these mortgage fraud cases have to foreclose. The property isn't being returned to them. They have to go and get it. They have to bear the expenses of the foreclosure proceedings. They have to hire attorneys to do it. They have to do the statutory filings. They have to do the statutory publications. And after they go through all of that, then they go through a sheriff's auction, and if their credit bid is the highest bid, if nobody else bids higher, then they get the property. That's hardly what we could call a return of the property to the victim. And
I
don't think.
Bid?
Pardon?
Was this a credit bid?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
So they had to take the property back because nobody else wanted to pay more.
In both cases, in the 9/11 Grand Street property, we do know the value of that. We do know the value of the original loan. That was on the exhibit that was testified about by Jim Farmer. It was $140,000. The 900 Inlet Shore property, the original loan was $330,000. In both cases, no mortgage payments were made at all. The loans were sold to investors. The 9/11 Grant Street property was acquired by Fannie Mae, which was in turn reimbursed by MGIC. The 900 Inlet Shores property was acquired by American Portfolio. Both of those were investors. They were not in the business of acquiring and renting properties. And so when they got those properties back, it's ludicrous to assume they weren't trying to get rid of them. Those properties were continuously on the market until they were able to be sold at a fair market price, at a arm's length transaction by actual buyers. And I would submit to the court that in cases like this, the proper interpretation of the MVRA is to allow the court to value the property for the offset purposes at the time that it actually sells, because that's the best measure of the actual loss. Otherwise, we get an absurd result. We have the district courts trying to reconstruct. In this case, the foreclosure occurred in 2006. The defendant is sentenced last year. The district court is supposed to try to reconstruct what might have been the fair market value of that property in 2006 when the foreclosure was complete of either of those two properties. How are they going to do that? The other 28J letter that I filed yesterday addressed this court's, it was the Buckman case, the other case in the 28J letter that I filed, addressed this court's acceptance of the notion that appraisals are only estimates, and appraisals can be influenced by an appraiser's desire to please the client that hires them. So how are we going to take an estimate that a property that might have been done?
If I could interrupt for a minute, I don't think we're just discussing in the abstract how fair market value should be evaluated.
Okay.
Because, you know, if we were, then you're probably right that actual sales are to be preferred over appraisals. We're talking about a statutory scheme that specifically directs the court to measure restitution in a case like this as referenced against the offset that could be realized as of the date the property is returned. And otherwise, in other words, where the fraud pertains to a collateralized loan, the property, or at least this is the interpretation that your opponent is arguing, the property at issue is the collateral, and when that comes back into the possession of the victim, that's the date by which we evaluate fair market value. And we may use sale information, actual sale information, if that date is relatively close to the date of the return of the property, or we may use appraisals, or we may use both. But whereas here we've got a 2.5-year gap, that actual sale is not the proper measure because it's supposed to be correlated to the date of the return of the property, at least under the statute. And that's where there's something of a circuit split emerging.
Right. And that's my point. My point is that the statute does not require the court to value the property collateral, because what was taken was money.
But that the courts don't disagree about that. The courts may disagree about whether you use the date of return or whether there's some elasticity there and you can go a few months after or a reasonable time after to measure actual sale or to take an actual sale into consideration. The courts seem to agree that in a case like this, the return of the collateral is the date.
The Ninth Circuit takes that position, and the Fifth Circuit takes that position. I don't think any other circuit has specifically taken that position, and I have frankly relied on the Third Circuit opinion in Himmler, which is not exactly the same because it's a settlement company that acquired a property that was sold as a result of fraud. But the court in Himmler said property is only worth what you can get for it. So we can't really value, we can't put a value for offset purposes on a property at the time that the victim takes possession of it if it's worthless to him, if he's unable to liquidate it.
What are we going to do with the issue of sentencing? What if an institution which takes back the property takes 4 years before they sell it? You going to hold off sentencing?
Actually, what
the situation?
What we have in our district, and I don't know how this is all going to play out because all of the defense attorneys have agreed to it. The courts have sentenced, have ordered restitution. Well, sentencing is a different issue because sentencing guidelines and
restitution comes up at the time of sentencing.
Yes, and the courts have ordered restitution in the full amount of the loan for the properties that haven't been sold to be reduced later by the amount of the sale. And the reason they've agreed to that is to prevent actually two things. One, from the victim not being made whole, and the other, from the victim obtaining a windfall if the property in fact sells for more than what the property is appraised at or valued at for the purpose of offset if the court were to do that at the time of the sentencing. So the district courts in our jurisdiction have been taking that position. I see my time is up. Does the court have other questions? Because I really strongly feel that this is something that this court needs to address, that we need some guidance on this.
Well, we intend to do that.
That's
why we're here today. Judge Mannion has a question.
The question was they want to suspend, I guess, with the decision on the amount of restitution based on what, so they don't maybe get a windfall or else a depreciation. Well, that's sort of a gamble. In this particular case, and here, first of all, it was fraudulent value in the first place.
Right.
And by a lot.
Right.
And so when they get the return of the property, it's already worth a lot less than the money they lost.
That's correct.
And then for whatever the delays in selling it, I didn't quite understand about this Fannie Mae. I think you were referring to something else, weren't you?
No. In the case of 900 Inlet Shores, The original lender was Paragon Lending. The loan was sold to Fannie Mae. Then Fannie Mae was the investor, and Fannie Mae buys loans or insures loans. So Fannie Mae had the loan at the time that the foreclosure occurred. The servicer foreclosed for Fannie Mae.
Okay, so
they couldn't
Fannie
sell it at auction, and then the insurer, MGIC, paid the claim for Fannie Mae. They took the property and mitigated the loss, mitigated it down to $52,000 from what it would have been if they hadn't have done that.
That sort of confuses me, at least, when you once the victim, so to speak, is passed along. I guess, is Fannie Mae the victim? At this point?
Well, at this point, the insurance company under the statute is entitled to be reimbursed for what the loss that the victim would have suffered because the insurance company insured default on the loan. So they're the ones who then took the loss and they liquidated the property and it mitigated the overall loss.
So is the insurance company trying to recover whatever they lost? I'm just...
Yes.
Okay. Kind of clouds the picture to me. That's
it. Well, and the mortgage fraud cases are so hard because the loans are sold almost immediately, and then there's an investor and there's a servicer, and trying to find out who's got what at the end is incredibly difficult.
If I could just clarify the nature of your argument, is it the government's position that the date of return subsection of the MVRA does not apply in this situation?
Yes. That the collateral, first of all, that the stolen property is money. The money was obtained by fraud. The money that was used to buy these properties was obtained by fraud. The collateral was a securitization. It was security to ensure the lender that, in fact, there was something that they could fall back on in order to recoup the money that they were giving in case something went wrong. The property wasn't returned to the victim.
Which subsection applies then?
Of
if that one doesn't.
They didn't get their property back until they were able to liquidate and get whatever money was.
Okay, so your argument, this is what I'm trying to get at here. Your argument is that section applies. It just should refer to the date of the sale and not the date.
The date that the victim was made whole by partially made whole by whatever proceeds could be realized from the sale of the property.
Okay, so you're modifying your earlier answer to my question, which is to say that the government does not contend that subsection B I Roman 2.
I didn't
doesn't apply, but that it should be interpreted as using the date of the actual sale.
Exactly. I guess I'm not doing very well here this morning. But my position is that the interpretation that counsel urges is not the correct interpretation of the statute. It does apply, but it's not the way it ought to be interpreted in the case of mortgage fraud cases where what the victim gets back is collateral. All right, which is not the same thing that has been taken from the victim, which is the money. And it shouldn't be interpreted that way because the collateral, A, is often inflated in the first instance, and B, there's really no fair way to value it at the time the victim lender.
Until it's sold, I think.
Until it's sold, exactly, which is what the Himmler said. Himmler case said. It said, property is only worth what you can get for it. So somebody gets, this isn't like the timber case where they get the timber back and they choose to hold on to it. Or it's not like somebody steals your TV and you get your TV back. This is a case where, A, they had to go after the property in order to get it, incur costs in order to make that happen, and then when they get it back, they can't sell it. You know, a for sale sign sitting in front of a house for 2 years, they're trying to sell it. These were investors. They were not in the business of trying to rent or rehabilitate or otherwise acquire property. They wanted to get rid of these properties, but they couldn't do it because of the market. And I think that the Rhodes case, which I cited in one of the sections of my brief, says that, you know, the defendant and not the victim bears the consequences of forces beyond its control. And the market forces in this case were forces that were beyond his control and beyond the victim's control.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Donovan.
Thank you. I cite on page 23, footnote 8 of my brief, and the government mentioned that the Fifth and Ninth Circuit talks about, yes, the return of the house wasn't the full amount of the money that was taken, but it should count as a partial return. And so that supports why, even though it was cash that was lended, the house should be used to offset part of that loss. The government is basically asking the court, the district court, and now this court of appeals, to provide the victims business insurance, in effect, because the market crash happened when they had control of the property. I don't think there's any doubt, again, that this property was returned February 21st, 2006, at least talking about the larger loan amount. And at this point, they have the ability to control it, and it's not in the record if they were trying to sell it. That might be a safe assumption to make, but we don't know. In fact, we just don't know what they were doing with the property. At that point in time, they could have very well have thought it's going to continue to increase. We're in a booming market. House prices are going up across the board. So when the government talks about that in this case, it's just not in the record. And I do take exception to the fact that these might have been inflated prices. I want to direct the court's attention to pages 45 and 46 of the sentencing restitution hearing transcript. This is where the FBI agent is testifying. He testified that the appraisers were not indicted. There's no indication that they were part of this this scheme. He testified that the appraisers, when interviewed, denied hitting the numbers, quote, hitting the numbers that were requested of them. He testified that James Lytle, which is one of the main ringleaders of this scheme, denied asking the appraisers to inflate the value. And James Lytle pled guilty, and he debriefed and was cooperative with the government, so I don't think he has a particular reason to lie about this. And basically, Agent Sheen acknowledged that in 2004, 2005, when these crimes are occurring, house prices are rising across the board. So I also take exception with her assertion that the prices were inflated. There's no evidence of this.
Stella, let me ask you a question. You're representing an individual who pleads in a case like this.
Yes.
And taking your position that we use a date of return, and the judge is about to determine restitution, would you be able in a situation like that to say, yeah, Judge, my position is date of return, but I see my experts tell me there's a rising market in 90 days. So do you ask the judge to delay? Which could you ask him to do that so that you might have to pay less in restitution because the market forces seem to suggest that you might pick up another $50,000,
$100,000? And I think
would that be an obligation of defense counsel under your position?
I think the answer to that would be no, because again the statute's clear, and this is why I think that the plain language has to be followed here to provide certainty and to provide a non-arbitrary time to value the property as it's valued when it's returned. The government basically is asking the court to ignore the plain language of the statute and use a value 2.5 years down the road, 3 years, 4 years.
Well, what
who knows?
What if the sentencing hearing and restitution occurs 2 years later, and you're saying you shouldn't gain the benefit of it if, let's say, it increases, the value increases?
That's right. This can cut both ways. Yes. I mean, again, the statute's clear. It is what it is, and I think that you value it the day it's returned. In this case, it was clearly returned February 21st, 2006. That's the time when you have to value the property. And again, it makes
just a battle, let's say, 2 years when sentencing occurs, let's say 2 years later, just a battle of experts on the appraisal, right? You bring in your experts at what it was worth 24 months before, and the government brings in theirs. Is that how we're going to arrive at when title passes or when property is recovered?
That could be part of the process, yes.
But how else would you do it?
Well, I think that is how you would do it. I wish that's what I would have done in this case. To be honest, I wish I would have thought of doing that to get a more accurate value of what it was at the time.
Well, if it had sold 2 months later, you wouldn't be objecting to using that value.
Right, and I agree. I think there could be some elasticity if it's relatively around the time, but clearly 31 months is not anywhere near the time.
Elasticity. Well, do you want an opinion suggesting 30 days? Well, how much room would we have in a reading of the statute for the sale, the assessment? That is the price assessment.
Yeah, I hadn't considered that. I mean, I don't think a lot. I don't think it should be a large amount of time because then you do run into this issue of, you know, when's...
No, 30 days to plant new seed, you know, new bushes, paint the garage. What kind of... What are we going to do here? I mean, we got to think about how to...
I would say no more than 30 days. I don't know. I mean, it has to. The plain language of the statute's clear. It's at the time it's returned. I don't think it should be much of a margin of error.
It's the winter versus the spring. You know, you can't dress up the property for sale as easily.
Well, and I also don't think this is a question of dressing it up and trying to make it better. It is what it's worth when it's returned. I mean, it is what it is. I don't know.
I'm just talking to the point that you seem to acknowledge, Mr. Donovan, that there could be some flexibility here.
Right. And I only say that just because I don't think you can value it instantaneously the exact moment title passes back to the victim.
It would be a tornado the day after you pass the property's returned, right? The roof collapses.
Right. You've
got to allow a little time for get the roof back, right?
And I think that, again, that risk should be at that point on the victim. This also goes to the part of my brief where I talk about transactional loss versus but-for loss, and I think, again, that this gets into areas of you have to draw a line at some point. The statute's clear where the line's drawn, and that's where you then have to value the property and use it for offset. I'm well past my time, I see.
You know, we all are, and that's unfortunate. But what length of time they defaulted and took back the property from the time that the money was given.
I'm sorry?
What was the space in time just from when the money was given?
Oh.
The $330,000, for example, was given to...
If I recall correctly, I believe that the loan was given in June of 2005, and then the property was returned February of 2006, so I believe it was 7 to 8 months.
7 to 8 months.
Yes.
So 7 to 8 months, and they say, well, it was worth $330,000 7 or 8 months ago. And so what you're saying is whenever they got it back, it may have been close to $330,000.
Exactly, because, again, we're talking...
Even though this whole thing was fraud, and I know they denied all this stuff, but let's face it, they pleaded guilty, it's a crime, and it was obviously greatly inflated when they did this.
Well, again, I don't concede or agree that it was greatly inflated. There's nothing in the record that supports that.
I'm just looking at it from the standpoint of what the reality of the situation is. I don't know anything about the neighborhood. It must have been okay. They sold it for something.
It's a nice area around Lake Geneva.
All right. Well, it is. I guess that's good. But anyway, that... I just look at what they gave and what they get back.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess maybe I'm with the dissent in the Ninth Circuit. So, anyhow, you did spend a long time here.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kraft. Case taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the sixth case.